XE.
Just calling to let you know. I'm sure you don't care, but we did terminate you last week on Thursday. So you no longer work here. Obviously, by you not showing up, that's pretty much a cause for it. I wanted to let you know that I did terminate you in the system to not be rehired by. So if you're thinking about going out to California, I wouldn't apply because you're not going to get hired. I would suggest next time you decide to quit a job, you actually call. Be a man and actually tell them that you're quitting. Best of luck to you, but it's not going to be with us. Talk to you later. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, that's one way to get fired, I guess. It's easy enough to delete your voice messages as long as somebody's paying the rent. I have a friend who had a ritual with his 2-year-old daughter every morning when he'd leave the house. "Where's Daddy going?" he'd ask her. "To work," she chirped. "And why is Daddy going to work?" "Bring home money." So we got to go to work, but there is a chance that sooner or later, in that friend's case, due to corporate takeovers, you just might have to find something else to do, bring home money. And that could be for the best, especially if you get fired for doing the right thing. Today on Stay Human, tales of termination and just how liberating it can be to be let go. Stay with us at least till the end of the shift.
In the stereo power of a city where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. My girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll be dead before your time is due.
Change when you're not ready. I mean, I got fired from a job I loved, and the thing I loved most about this job was how useful it made me feel. Folks were counting on me every day. Lots of regulars, some of the old-timers, ready to go when I opened up at 11 a.m., lining up for their first 3-2 beers of the day. This was at the Legion Hall in Hackensack, Minnesota. Population then, 109. I lived nearby, new in town, very obviously new. Wild long hair, hippie glasses. I had just moved up north from a different world, and bartending at the Legion, that really made me feel, well, not always exactly welcome, but at least like I belonged there. I wouldn't say the Legion was the center of community life. That might have been the Muni bar and liquor store down the street, but it was pretty lively and always local at the Legion. And I got to make friends and make friendly and make drinks with, it seemed like, everybody for miles around. And to this day, I am still proud of what my boss, Phyllis, told me. All the customers like you, she said. I never had a complaint. And you closed down real clean. I appreciate that. This was after she'd told me not to come in on Monday. I'm sorry, but you can't work here anymore. Because of the party the night before, it was somebody's special event that kept us legally open way past closing time. Long tables were set out, and for me, a lot of running back and forth. And a little after 2 a.m., Phyllis announced to the lingerers that it was time to go. Drive safe, everybody. Party's over. And maybe 15 minutes later, she had had enough and told me, clear the tables. You know those moments in your life where if you got a do-over, you'd get it right? And who knows how different things might have turned out. I mean, I might have eventually become the manager of the Legion once Phyllis retired. But no, clear the tables, she said, and that's just what I did, including the long neck in front of Al, who said, hey, I'm not done with that, and I shrugged and kept doing like I was told, clear the tables. I have no choice, Phyllis told me on the phone. He says, if I don't fire you, he won't drink here anymore, and you know what that means. I did. Al cut a very big figure in Hackensack in those years. He had moved there years before from Chicago, and he bought a lot of drinks for his friends, and he was friends with everybody. If Al moved his party to the Muni, well, I gotta do what he says, Phyllis tells me, and then the part about no complaints. At the end of that party on his way out, Al cursed me up and down, just really let me have it. I was stunned. Don't remember anything he said, but I have an image of myself standing there with my mouth open, frozen with shock. Don't worry about it, a few friends said after he left. He'll forget it in a day or two. But now, it wasn't just my income. I'd have to find some way to replace that. But my purpose, my whole identity in Hackensack yanked out from under me. And I could have just handed his bottle back to him. Would that have been so hard? I know it's a little late in coming, Al, but I'm sorry for disrespecting you. At the time, I did not know what to do with myself. I remember a few days just sitting around the house, moping, and listening to the new FM radio station out of Grand Rapids. I called them up and said, could I come work for you? And they said, well, come over and have a visit. And I wound up making some new friends, so I guess it worked out all right in the rear view. I sure was sorry, though, to give up my position at the Legion Club. That's what that job was, a position. And I'll tell you one thing for sure, I will never clear your place before you're done. I'm Michael Goldberg. Coming up, my friend Dan's fantasy job crashes into reality.
Say, these cats is broke, I knows them. Throw them out the doors and close them. Get them out of here. Spirits sagging, funds are low. This occupation's got to go. Up pulls the limo, up goes a thrill. The suits are picking up the bill. It's all right for them to tag along. It's just one bill they're tagging on. I'll find some way to get along. The business suits do the rescue.
So nice doing business with you. You will really hate the clown when you realize that all they're selling down for the deal. The suits are picking up. The suits are picking up the bill. Where I'm standing, my friends have passed out on the landing.
Good night.
Guess what too many has left us high and dry. I'll be feeling down.
The suits get light in time.
Some folks are lucky enough or stubborn enough to be mostly self-employed throughout their working lives. The downside of that is you can get used to it, and if you do work for somebody else, it can be a lot harder. Here's my old friend Dan Paris remembering a job he had in California.
I worked for Daniel's Woodland for approximately 4 years, and really it looked like the most fun job that I would ever have, just because it was building things that brought cartoons to life. I would watch the kids interact with these structures, and it brought a lot of joy to parents and to us as well. The tree houses were built so you didn't need a tree to put it in it. It was a tree house that came with its own tree. We took these recycled, salvaged 10-foot diameter sequoias out of the foothills of California that had been there. They were stumps basically left over from the logging years in the 1800s. And we would core them out, cutting a big square block out of them with a chainsaw. And then we would cut in windows and doors and build ladders right into the walls that would allow you to get up into a treehouse. And the treehouse would typically have a, you know, sort of a crooked roof and little crooked windows and ropes and little pulleys and all kinds of things for the kids to do. So, I mean, this was a, and so that was our signature product. So I was hired by this company to, you know, do larger special products, you know, just, you know, do an entire environment and, you know, imagine how it would be used. So one example was I built a replica of the General Sherman redwood tree, which is the largest redwood in the world, and turned it into a party venue for this family entertainment center. And included was a platform for a zip line that where you could zip line across this auditorium right into the tree. And then for another party room, I had a log house that I had built, you know, just a small log structure that was poking out of the side of the tree and resting on a rock climbing wall that we had built as well. So typical rock climbing walls, you would see, you know, these handholds that are bolted into the wall. This one, I took latex and I put it on actual climbing rocks in the Sierras. And then so we molded this wall to have natural handholds and footholds so that there weren't these things attached to it. And then they had these automatic belay machines that were available, so you didn't need somebody there holding a rope. But so, you know, and another thing was I took a crew to Croatia. We built a pirate ship nightclub. And this was, I mean, it was about a 200-foot long, 80-foot high pirate ship. And, you know, I built a jail, I blew holes in it, like cannon blasts. And so it was just to create a fun environment. You know, the cocktail waitresses, if guests were misbehaving, I made it so that they could lock them in a jail. And you know, so it was all fun, and the Croatians just loved it. I mean, they thought it was the greatest thing ever. So I did this for several years. I mean, I traveled all around. We did shooting galleries and floats for Disneyland. And this was really one of the first. I'd never really had a job. I was used to working on my own all the time, and this was, you know, it was fun. You know, but I got to do my own thing, and. You know, all of a sudden I thought, you know, I'm making this company all kinds of money, and, you know, I'm not really asking for too much here. So when I did, it was owned by a couple brothers. So when I did ask for, you know, a raise, and it was a substantial raise, instead I got fired. So, and, you know, when I think back of it, I could, you know, I was shocked at the time. But I thought, wow, thanks, you know. I needed to go back on my own again and explore my own creativity rather than interpreting somebody else's.
Thanks to Dan Paris. Coming up, sudden departures from a candle factory and a high-end bakery. Here's They Might Be Giants.
There's a house at the top of a tree. There's a house at the top of a tree. In the house, there's a room in the room. There's a chair, and sitting in the chair is you. There's a nose at the end of a snout, of a dog with his head out the window, of a car that's driving away from the tree. And at the top of a tree, there's a house, and in the house, there's a room, and in the room, there's a chair, and in the chair is you. There's a plan to eat the house in the mind of a mouse in the woods. And the mouse in the woods has a smell that's detected by the nose at the end of the snout of a dog. And the dog has his head out the window of a car. And the car is driving away from the tree. And at the top of a tree, there's a house, and in the house, there's a room, and in the room, there's a chair, and in the chair is you. Potato chips left in the empty bag in your hand, and the crumpling sound of the empty bag makes the mice get mad. And when the mice get mad, it leads to a plan to eat the house. And the plan's in the mind of the mouse in the woods. And the mouse in the woods has a smell that's detected by the nose at the end of a snout of a dog. And the dog has his head out the window of a car. And the car is driving away from the tree. And at the top of a tree, there's a house, and in the house, there's a room, and in the room, there's a chair, and in the chair is you. And the reason there are no more chips in the empty bag in your hand is that the crumpling sound of the empty bag makes the mice get mad, which leads to a plan to eat the house. But just in time, the dog arrives to give to the mouse the potato chips that you took from the bag and gave to the dog to deliver to the mouse, so the mouse would not eat you.
Top it with a bow tie ribbon, stop it. Eating all the rainbow cookies, pies are flying through the roof. Not my first pick, but I'll do it. Make the cash right so I can move quick. I'll go with a new whip, cream on top, and I'd approve it. Pack it, box it, flip it, top it.
Pack it, box it, flip it, top it.
Pack it, box it, flip it, top it.
Pack it, box it, flip it, top it.
My boss is Mother Mary, cause we're slipping through the concrete. Show no mercy, step right on me. It's a little death to me, the purgatory. The bakery trying to make some more. They expect me to stay when I should go. Grab
are flying through the roof. Oh, Cherry, the way they all go. Knock them down like she a dodgeball. Little mess up and she's angry. One downfall, so blame the whole team. Pack it, box it, flip it, top it.
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 The bakery. Trying to make some more. They expect me.
Song from Jane at the Bakery. Our next story comes from Christine Jenkins.
Well, this was in Madison in 1971, and I was just out of library school. I'd just gotten a master's, and so, of course, I didn't want to be a librarian. No, just leave that out. Okay, anyway, so I was looking for a job. The Ovens of Brittany, which was a very high-class French restaurant, something that Madison had never seen before, was opening a new area in their restaurant that was going to be, they had, it was the Ovens of Brittany, and they had dinners. And now it was going to be breakfast and lunch. And there was going to be it was going to be called the Baker's Rooms, and it was going to have lots of baked goods, and the bakers were going to be making it right in front of people's eyes. They had the ovens there, and they had these big marble slabs where we would roll things out, and industrial size rolling pins that were worked with ball bearings because they were so heavy. Anyway, I said, I really wanted to bake. And the woman who hired me, Odessa, said, well, I think you really have a passion for baking. So I got hired, and it was just a blast. There was about five other bakers there. We were all women, and we were all in our early to mid-20s, and we were very enthusiastic and energetic. And we were making something beautiful, and it smelled wonderful. So there we were, and now the restaurant was just getting sort of structured all around us. So we were in jeans or shorts and T-shirts, and then great big voluminous white baker's aprons, and hairnets, of course. And the croissants in particular were just wonderful, where it would be cool rising, so it rose all night long, and then you would take the dough out, and you would have a slab of butter that had been shaped into sort of a bar, and then you would put the dough down, and you would close it up so that it would encase the butter, and then you would take out your rolling pin and go bam, 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 bam. And then it would be very big, of course. And then you go slap it together again and go, bam, bam, bam. It was just to keep going and going. It was so fun. And then we'd have the rolling thing to cut it out was also a roller that where you had, it was like a cookie cutter, only went and made triangles. And then you go, the restaurant was being created around us, but there was more to the restaurant than just serving food. It had been founded by a woman and her cult from Chicago, and her name was Johanna. And her cult was all people that were sort of our age, but her religion was sort of theosophy, and it was sort of astrology, and it was sort of celestial footprints up on the window, and it was all sorts of things like that. And so she would be coming into the restaurant, and everybody would be like sort of hovering around her and practically acting like you were worshiping her. And she was just this sort of like elegant, a little scary looking middle-aged lady who looked sort of like Morticia, but always was very well dressed. And she had a special bone china cup that she wanted her coffee in. And of course, bone china would make things, it's very thin, and so the coffee would get cool very quickly, but she had to have it boiling hot. So whoever was waiting on her had to, like, be hovering around. And so the people who worked there all had these, they weren't just bakers, they were people who were embodying a philosophy that didn't make a lot of sense to me anyway, but that was part of it. So we were being slowly turned into people who would, we didn't have to join the cult, but we had to, like, you know, have uniforms and spritting, but oh well. But then, because we were in the bakery, we started very early in the morning, and there was basically two shifts in the day. There was the early shift, which was starting at between 5:30 and 6 in the morning, and going till about 2 in the afternoon, and that was the ones where they would really be taking the dough that had risen all night and creating wonderful loaves of bread and baguettes and croissant. And but then there was the second shift, which was about from noon to about 8 at night, and the second shift was you had to do all the cleaning up. You know, a bakery has to be nice and clean all the time. And you would be making the dough and putting it into chilled tubs. And it was no fun. So we kind of spread it. So we had the good shifts and the bad shifts. So we sort of spread them out among us. Well, then Johanna gave down an edict that the bakers who were married should have all the good shifts and the single bakers should have the bad shifts, because the married bakers needed to be home at time in the evening to make dinner for their husbands. And that was really kind of the last straw. I just, you know, it felt like you kind of indulged their religious beliefs because you didn't want to, like, hurt anybody's feelings, but really. So, and so I said in a very sassy tone to my baker friends, say, well, I don't know about this, because, you know, if I'm single and if being married is so important, then as a single person, I should have all the good shifts, because how the heck am I going to ever meet a husband if I'm out every night, if I'm working every night? That's just not going to work at all. And of course I was being sarcastic, but it was also funny. And so I think other people were repeating that. And so anyway, one day I got called in, and they didn't even have the whatever. We were in the restaurant. Everybody's eating all around us. And Odessa, our boss, was telling me that I hadn't done a good enough job, that I had left the yeast out of the dough and all this stuff. It was like things that couldn't possibly be true. But clearly, I had been fired for insubordination. Then I went to the Human Rights Commission and said I was being fired. I had been fired for religious discrimination. And so they set a date for me, for the people from the ovens and me, to talk to the human rights coordinator. And as I looked at them, I just thought, you know, I don't want to work with these people. I want to work with my buddies, the bakers. I do not want to work with Phoenix people. And so they said, well, what do you want from us? And I said, I want you to promise me that you won't, if you're asked for a recommendation, I don't want you to ever give me a negative one, because I did very good work, and you know that perfectly well. And I don't want the job anymore. I'm working in a library now, and I'm perfectly happy, but I really don't want a negative evaluation. And they said, oh, no, we will never do. Oh, yeah, you did a good job. Yeah, right.
That's Christine Jenkins. The follow-up report is she never, for the rest of her life, got hired as a baker again. Worked out okay, though. She went on to a stellar career, first as a school librarian, and then as university faculty at Champaign-Urbana, training the next generations of librarians.
Now, let me see. Under the present do-it-as-mill system, this book belongs...
Wow! Look at all these books! Me never seen so many books before!
Shh!
Oh, yeah, right.
Quiet, please.
I did not see waste basket.
All right.
Excuse me, sir. Sir, could you tell me what you're doing with all these books here?
Oh, well, why, this is a library. Yes, people come here to borrow books they'd like to read.
Oh, that's terrific. This library.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's great, because me try hard to read.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah.
Now, what can I get you?
Well, me want a book about Little Red Riding Hood.
All right.
And one box of cookies, please.
Maybe you don't understand. You see, this is a library.
Yeah?
Yes, we have books here. Only books. We have no cookies.
Oh.
You understand?
Me see. Okay.
Right,
okay. Then let's see. Me take book of nursery rhymes.
All right.
And a box of cookies, please.
We don't have cookies. We only have books. Just books. No cookies. All right?
Oh, yeah, right. Got it now. Okay. Then, let's see. Me take a picture book.
Picture book.
Yeah, and a box of cookies.
How many times do I have to tell you we don't have cookies? Only books.
Oh, okay.
Just books.
Okay.
No cookies.
Okay. No get upset. Okay. Don't get excited. Me not fussy.
All right.
Just give me a box of cookies.
No! We don't have cookies. No cookies. Just books. That's all. No cookies. Understand? Just books. Books.
You know what? Me get feeling you only have books.
That's right. Just books.
Me got it now. Okay.
All right.
Good.
At last.
Good.
Now, what do you want?
Me want book about cookies.
Fine, that we have. A book about cookies. Good.
And a glass of milk, please.
Cookie Monster, always welcome on Stay Human, our weekly mix of words and music, broadcast on KAXE, KBXE, streaming at KAXE.org. Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota, supported by the folks who listen to it. This program receives additional support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, part of our state's legacy funds. Coming up in this hour, two stories of slamming up against the established order and getting fired for it. But first, a variation on the theme from Grand Rapids writer Anne-Marie Erickson, who says, "You can't fire me. I quit."
When I was in my early 20s and lived in Minneapolis, I had a variety of jobs, from laundry maid at St. Mary's Hospital to editorial assistant for TV Guide magazine, even though I didn't own a television, to billing clerk for the publisher of all things astrological, to teacher's aide at a school of last resort for students who didn't fit into the regular high school setting, to a printer's assistant at Dayton Hudson corporate headquarters in the Ideas Tower, to a candle factory worker. To call the candle factory a factory may conjure up images of a large place. Actually, it was a one-room operation located in the warehouse district downtown. That large room had a furnace on one end, water baths along another wall, and long tables in the middle. Two guys ran the furnace, melting wax to make the candles and adding various scents to the batches, cranberry, pine, vanilla. We women wicked the metal molds, knotting a pre-cut wick at the bottom hole, threading it up through the mold, then tying the wick to a 4-inch common nail that spanned the rim. The molds were set into the water baths, and the guys would pour molten wax into them. Then they'd open the windows above the water baths to speed up the cooling process. This was in midwinter. The room temperatures swung from the heat of that furnace to the winter's cold throughout our shift. I had a head cold most of the time I worked there. After the candles had solidified, we untied the wicks from the nail and extracted the candles from the molds. Then we wiped off stray bits of wax, wrapped the candles in cellophane, and applied the company's gold label. After work, I'd catch a bus on Washington Avenue, which deposited me on the corner of Cedar and Riverside. I walked the remaining 5 blocks to the tumble-down duplex I rented. If it were a particularly cold night, first I'd stop at the 400 bar and order a peppermint schnapps to warm me up for the walk. Pool players and beer drinkers and musicians like Willie Murphy inhabited that place. Inevitably, someone near me would comment, "Must have been making cranberry candles today." My hair and clothes reeked of the scents, and my handsome fry boots often were covered with splats of tinted wax, red or green or white. I might have left work, but I couldn't quite get away from the candle factory. Our supervisor at the factory was a 30-ish woman, short, sharp-featured, and brisk. She was married to one of the furnace guys. For some reason, she chose to pick on me, regularly criticizing my work. I speculated that it was because I got along well with the rest of the crew and managed to have some fun. One day, after yet another critique of my work, I turned to a friend and said, "She does that one more time today, and I'm quitting." A little later, she stood behind me and barked, "Don't do that with such affection," as I carefully wiped wax off a candle. I slammed my fist on the table. "That's it. Why do you have it in for me? I quit. I want my check now." She ordered the other workers to leave. They retreated to the break room. One friend started to cry as she left. Then, seated across from one another at a work table, the supervisor and I talked. I don't recall what either of us said, other than I insisted on getting paid before I left and wanted her to own up to what she had against me. She made excuses. She told me about the stress she was under. Then she started to cry. I didn't relent. She spoke to one of the owners. I got my check, said my goodbyes to my co-workers, and left. A few weeks later, as I walked through a downtown skyway, I passed a gift shop. There she was, behind the counter. I learned from a co-worker that she'd left her supervisory position at the candle factory after I'd quit because she was so unhappy in her job. And so it was. Not for the first time, nor for the last, that I was the canary in the coal mine at a toxic, dysfunctional workplace. But it struck me then, it strikes me 50 years later, how my supervisor's intended insult, "Don't do that with such affection," was remarkably perceptive. My absorption in the task at hand annoyed her. She demanded briskness, not careful attention. But I could do my work no other way, so I quit.
Thanks to Anne-Marie Erickson. Sometimes when it's over, it's not over. Here's Sue Merrill.
I worked in a private regional laboratory in another state for 14 years. Putting myself through a medical technology program while I worked, I enjoyed the education and the job that someday had even more promise after certification. My coworkers were mostly women who ran the daily testing. Mid-managerial positions were filled with mostly males. One particular manager had a name shared by some of us that included the warning, "Hands off." I was among the few of us exasperated with his tactics. Some women encouraged him. This was the mid-80s, before the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill scandal. The perpetrator's favorite move was a sneak up from your blind side while you were walking, wrapping his arm around your back, squeezing you into him as he groped the side of your breast. Your personal bubble could also be broken in a stationary position, your hands busy with glassware or lab specimens. Moving or standing, sitting with his face close to yours, he managed to get his hands on you, smiling and cajoling and distracting you from his intent. I had learned to twist myself away from him as he came swooping by. My look of disgust never seemed to drive the point home until one day he got me in the stairwell with the old side grope squeeze. Somehow I managed to get my elbow into his ribs and yelled, "Knock it off," and that seemed to end his behavior with me. Maybe it was my visit to human resources, which was most likely glossed over because the perp was the golden boy in upper management's eyes. As my education ended and my certification became reality, I applied for the new field services position. Patriarchy still ruled in 1987, and the perpetrator was bestowed the managerial position of the field reps, one of which was me. After all, I had proposed the new position for Tex to improve best practices with our customers. No other lab offered this great service, and I was not going to give it up just because of him. They also hired one of our customers for a second position, and little did I know, my job would also entail being a whistleblower. The new hire would be his next victim. After his first grope, she was petrified. She was new and didn't want trouble. A meeting with HR and a work grievance counselor was helpful, but I sensed HR was doing nothing other than putting notes in the perp's file with no action. The grievance counselor advised we document every incident with dates, locations, and any witnesses. Never shut the door to his office, she said, and never be alone with him. The counselor described the harassment as an untreated condition, and we were the symptoms, pesky but treatable, with the two of us potentially going away. We got the treatment, just as the counselor predicted. The pressure and downright lies on our performance hounded us for 2 years. The perpetrator slipped up again with my coworker, opening her jacket to demonstrate a nonsensical pat-down. It was witnessed by a male coworker passing by his office. This was good because it was someone other than me reporting to HR. The perp got a 2-week furlough. Upper management balked at firing their golden boy, and the symptoms kept dancing around the disease. It was exhausting. They're going to have to fire us if we want to litigate, I told my coworker. That was 1989. She couldn't take it anymore and resigned. I was fired in 1991 after 14 years with this company. Sitting across from the attorney, she leveled her eyes at both me and my husband, who also worked at the lab. Do you want both of you fired? Because that's what will happen, she said. You have 7 years to litigate. 3 years later, a big national lab swallowed up the little fish lab and dissolved the company. HR files were opened up and the perpetrator was let go. I had moved on in jobs and life. I watched the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas trials in 92 with the hope of not ever having to see him in the Supreme Court system. But he's still around, and so is that disease.
Thanks to Sue Merrill. She told me that story a few years ago, not long after she had retired from what she says was the most rewarding part of her career as a medical technologist with the Indian Health Service at Red Lake.
Yo, this is a story of a male-female threat to society. You know, being misjudged and not respected for what we are. But I want to send a special shout-out to my girl, Tawana Brown. Because no matter what we say or what we do, they'll always believe his story. Without being new, girls have an image too. take it from me. Don't be a victim of society. You can't put yourself in a position to be neglected and disrespected. You have to do what's not expected.
Group. We have one more story today of getting fired, this time in public. Here's Joe Morrissey.
I had been working in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It was in the midst of my second year as a Vista volunteer, which had grown out of the war on poverty, and we were working on housing in New Mexico. And we had a pretty good reputation. I got contacted to see if we'd be interested in taking a Vista assignment as a supervisor in Waterloo, Iowa, which was a neighboring community to where I'd gone to school at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. And I'd lived in Waterloo, so I knew my way around there fairly well, and started the job in February. And I had a team of 14 Vista volunteers, and they were working in housing with kids, young kids. This was the beginnings of the Head Start movement, some healthcare related stuff, things related to the poverty of that particular community. It was 80,000 people with the biggest John Deere plant in the world and a packing house, but a lot of discrimination. And my role was to help do something around housing, especially for the Black community, all under the approval of the County Board of Supervisors, who had hired me. Well, we got off on a great start. I really loved the team. I hadn't been there that long until I realized what a real powder keg education was in Waterloo. It is famously one of the most discriminatory communities in segregation and education. And there were literally no Black kids at the West High School. It was either Black or white type of a community. And by April, I'd begun in February, by April, there was an incident at the West High School. They had 40 kids, Black kids had been sent there that year. They called them literally young pioneers to integrate the high school. And at the end of the school year, a speech class teacher had one of the kids read Little Brown Cocoa and the Preacher's Watermelon, and it had all kinds of incredible stereotypes. It was really designed to get their goat, and it did. And the kids called up their parents. I said, "This is ridiculous." And they went to the assistant principal and said, "You got to do something." And they principal refused to do anything against this teacher. And the kids, including some of their white friends, went into the principal's office, closed the door, penciled it in so the cops couldn't bust in. And the cops came anyway and tried to shoot tear gas into the room. The kids are all frantically calling their parents. And it's a big explosion, social explosion in town. And one of the people I had been working with in housing was a local pastor of an AME church. And he says, "So what can you guys do?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm looking for some direction from you." And he said, well, there's going to be a demonstration over at Logan Plaza, and there's going to be a meeting tonight. He invited me to this meeting. It was a big meeting. It was like 300 people. And because it was a violence-prone community in terms of police response, they decided to hold it in the basement of the Jesse Cosby Center. A lot of people down there. I was the only white guy in the room. And what can we do as VISTAs? And VISTA meaning Volunteers in Service to America. And the request was that we integrate the picket line out at Logan Plaza, which was the only large economic center on the east side of town. And they were afraid of violence. So we were going to integrate that picket line with some white faces, which is what we did. And of course, we didn't have any other transportation. So we drove some of our federal International Harvester scouts out there. And that became a big deal. And the fact that there were VISTAs there in the conservative newspaper, that was a big deal. It was front page stuff. My name was front page stuff. And all I was trying to do was be helpful. The whole VISTA program became like a flashpoint at that stage. Although we were a tiny portion of the demonstration, that there were whites integrated with this black community was frowned on. Put it lightly. I started getting calls from the lady who had hired me, who was a national representative of the Republican Party. This was during the Nixon administration. And she was saying, I don't see how we're going to keep you guys. And they had the County Board of Supervisors called for a meeting. There were 400 to 500 people there, highly charged. Ultimately, the question was, do we keep or send these VISTAs back where they came from? And the vote was 3-2 to end the program. So I've been there all of 3.5 months probably. And I suddenly didn't have a job. But I had a lot of friends there in Waterloo in the black community. That was cool. And I was sent bundling back to New Mexico to join my wife back there and carry on with our work in New Mexico. So that was my firing, and I've got to say, it felt pretty good. Having gone back to New Mexico, I got a call from one of the guys who had been on my VISTA team, actually it's the VISTA leader, Tom Knoll, almost a year later. And he said that the American Friends Service Committee was looking for another VISTA program, and would I be willing to come back and lead that? And I said, yes. And I went back, interviewed, got the job. Everything was all figured out. VISTA had already been agreed to by the regional office in Kansas City for the war on poverty. And they said, okay, everything's good here. Did you guys get a supervisor? Yes. Yes, we did. A guy named Joe Morrissey. Well, they freaked out. They said, well, anybody but him. And the Quakers said, that's not how we do things. We make our own decisions. And if this is not good with that, then we'll just have to create our own program. So they did. And so I worked on developing a program inside outside in the Waterloo community. And again, same people, same friends. And it was excellent. Excellent bounce back from a one firing and one refusal in the course of 1 year.
Thanks to Joe Morrissey for getting fired and for telling us about it. And the same goes to Sue Merrill, Anne-Marie Erickson, Christine Jenkins, and Dan Paris, all on the You're Fired edition of Stay Human. I'm Michael Goldberg. We'll be back next week with more story and song for spirit and courage.
Oh, yeah. You better listen, sisters and brothers, because if you do, you will hear there are voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will till we all come to understand that none of us are free.
the darkness, they just can't see the light. And if you don't say it's wrong, that says it's right. We got to try to feel for each other, let our brothers know that we care. Got to send a message, send
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids.